Hello, I'm Caleb Howard, and this is Tales from Sacred Texts. The world is built on stories. From the beginning of time, humans have immersed themselves in legends and myth. When God himself wanted to explain to us what he was like, he didn't push elaborate treatises, but instead told stories about humanity. In this podcast, I tackle the concept of religion through stories and legends. Told through a 21st century lens, I explain to religious and non-religious people alike the stories that lie at the very heart of the belief that maybe there is a God, and maybe he really is good. We'll be doing one of the more unique and fascinating stories from the Bible, hidden in the book of Numbers, far away from the more popular stories. In fact, I hadn't thought much about this story at all for a very long time, until I heard an incredibly unbiblical sermon on the story that twisted its meaning, got many of the facts wrong, and was topped off by the pastor's declaration of disbelief in the Bible. It was that sermon that made me decide to put this story on my podcast to set the record straight. I also needed a short story to balance things out after how long I've been going on these recent episodes. There is a content warning for this week. Some moderate brutality to animals, the usual violence, and some mild dehumanization of women. It'll be your pretty classic ancient world stuff. If that's a problem for you, maybe skip this episode. If not, we'll keep going. To set the stage, these events take place around 40 years after the rebellion of Korah from episode 206, which in turn happens subsequent to season 1's episodes on Moses, but you don't need to have listened to those episodes to hear this one. Basically, the Hebrews escaped slavery in Egypt and began their journey to the Promised Land. Unfortunately, when they reached the Promised Land, they were too cowardly to go in, all the way up to attempting to kill anyone who wanted to go. Due to their cowardice, God told them they would have to spend 40 more years wandering in the wilderness before they could attempt to invade the Promised Land again. These years are now coming to a close, and the Hebrews are approaching the kingdom of Balak, a kingdom on the very border of the Promised Land. That's where our story begins. King Balak looked on the hordes of people invading his kingdom. Well, sort of. He was mostly looking up at dust. Kicked up by men, women, children, and cattle, a massive dust storm was coming his way. A massive dust storm full of people. Balak had tried to call his allies, but the king knew that even if all of them showed up, and they wouldn't, they were too scared, he would have far too few men to win a battle. The king knew that his kingdom was about to fall. He summoned his courtiers to try to cook up some last-ditch strategy to save the kingdom. They spoke in nervous confusion, coming up with increasingly ridiculous plans that were unlikely to work. No one came up with anything even close to useful. Finally, the courtier in the back, who everyone had been talking over the whole time, rolled his eyes exasperatedly and spoke. The king should try Balaam. Balaam? Was that a kind of drug that would make him forget the whole thing? Because, yeah, nice, he'd like to try some of that, but it wouldn't fix his problems. The courtier rolled his eyes even further back. Balaam was a man. A well-known man, actually. Balaam was a prophet. No, prophet wasn't that accurate. Balaam was a diviner. A wizard. Better yet, he was one of those seedy type characters in movies that you could get anything from and you just didn't ask how he got it and you just handed him some money. A regular Mundungus Fletcher, but a lot more competent. Whoever Balaam cursed was cursed, and whoever Balaam blessed was blessed. Okay. King Balak wasn't super excited, but this was his last best hope. The courtier vouched for this guy, said he was from Balaam's home country and the guy was literally feared over there. His reputation preceded him. So the next day, the king sent messengers to Balaam. Balaam greeted them warmly and asked why they'd come. What did they need done? Who did they need cursed? Did they bring the money? The thing was that Balaam did actually have power, and he got it from Yahweh. Balaam was, in theory, a prophet of Yahweh, even though he didn't act like it all the time. But despite the fact that he was paid for his services, Balaam normally used his magic for good, so God kept allowing him to use those powers. But that was the hang-up. Because when King Balak's messengers came and asked Balaam to curse the Jews, and Balaam begged God to please let him do this, Yahweh's answer was clear. No. So Balaam reluctantly told the messengers that God was not going to let him do this, and they may as well head home. That man drives a hard bargain. King Balak grumbled. He had offered a good amount of money and felt pretty insulted that Balaam hadn't chosen to come. But he was desperate, so he sent a group of men much more important than the first group, and even more money. The messengers encouraged Balaam not to hesitate. There would be a significant reward for his trouble. Balaam was extremely stressed with God's prohibition on going to help the king because he loved money. And this was, wow, a lot of money. Like, take his regular fee and multiply it by 1,000 and you might be getting close to what King Balak was offering him. Balaam was so stressed that he got a little too snippy. He yelled back at the messengers that even if he got all of King Balak's gold, silver, and treasures, he would not be going because Yahweh would not allow it, attempting to shout the temptation away. The messengers looked on in shock and horror as Balaam asked him to spend the night as he harassed God for permission to go. Hadn't he just said that God wouldn't allow him? The man was unstable. They waited for Balaam to shuffle off to his bedroom and then noped on out of there. They didn't know if he'd come out screaming and using magic or if he was actually incompetent and didn't want to get exposed, but either way, they weren't paid by the hour. Coming back to Balak early wasn't going to get them in trouble, and they weren't going to stay in Balaam's smelly, filthy prophet shack for another minute. Balaam managed to wheedle permission, of sorts, out of God. It took him all night, too. But in the end, God told Balaam he could go with the messengers under one condition. If he said only what God told him to say. Despite the fact that God had already told him that he could not say the words that would get him paid, Balaam decided to go with the messengers and figure the rest out later. But when he emerged from his room, the messengers were gone. God had said nothing about going on his own, but God had said nothing about not going on his own, so Balaam figured that he'd try that and see what happened. It went well until it didn't. The problem came when Balaam's donkey literally saw God, with his mean face on and a sword in his hand. The donkey, logically, took off running into a field. Balaam, who could not see God after spending the last few days insulting and disobeying him, pulled out his stick and hit the donkey hard, yelling some curses. Where was this stupid animal going? He needed to catch up to the messengers. Yelled at the donkey in pain and fury when it crushed his foot up against a wall. They were walking on a narrow path surrounded by brick walls that in turn surrounded vineyards. When the donkey saw God this time, there was nowhere to go and no way to turn around, so the donkey attempted to squeeze past God and his big sword, and to the donkey's great credit, it was successful. Not knowing that his donkey literally helped him evade God with a sword, Balaam howled as he whipped the donkey brutally. Balaam's literally incredible ride suffered in silence and started plodding along again, wondering what he had done in life to get this much punishment. The worst part of the trip came a few miles down the road when God showed up again in an extremely narrow place where the donkey couldn't even turn, so it just sat down. Balaam got up and beat it mercilessly with his staff. He screamed, frothed, and cursed. Stupid beast. Balaam heard a voice. A uniquely donkeyish voice. I'm not exactly sure what a donkey's voice sounds like, but either Balaam instinctively recognized it, or just saw literally nobody else around and I guess had to assume the voice was his donkey. But Balaam knew who was talking when he heard the sad words. What did I do wrong? The donkey moaned. Why did I deserve to be beaten? Now, if I had the chance to speak to my pet, I would have had to think about what to say for a while. I could list a thousand things I'd want to ask her, from what's it like to be a cat, to what could I do to make your life better, to please tone the meowing down while I'm sleeping. Balaam apparently had none of these on his list. Instead, Balaam's first words to his pet were the equivalent of, I wish I had a gun so I could shoot you dead. Excuse me, said the donkey. What's a gun? Oh, I meant a sword. A weapon. Anything I could use to kill you. The donkey rolled its donkey eyes or did whatever donkeys do when they are just so done with humans. You have ridden me for years, it told Balaam. When had the donkey ever been hard to deal with or anything less than the best donkey ever? Could Balaam just give his donkey some grace here? It had a perfectly good reason for being inconvenient. God chose that exact moment to reveal himself to Balaam, and Balaam's reaffirmation of his desire to kill his pet turned to ice in his mouth as he shuddered. His donkey had saved him from that? The donkey nodded, kind of proud despite the fact that it had literally the worst owner ever. It was a good donkey. I want to take a brief moment to criticize some interpretations of this passage. A lot of people point to Balaam and are like, good thing he didn't have a sword. They've tried to infer that weapons are sinful, ignoring the whole problem. The problem isn't that Balaam could have been armed. The problem is that Balaam wanted to kill his pet. The lack of a weapon made no difference to Balaam. Good chance he would have beaten his donkey to death if it hadn't shocked him by starting to talk. The problem was that Balaam was an evil man. He had no regard for God or others, only himself. And that's basically what God told Balaam. He was reckless and brutal. God would have killed Balaam for the way he was acting and have found the donkey a much better owner. But the donkey saved Balaam's life when it ran from God. Balaam bowed before God. He was sorry. If he had just seen God, he would have been nicer to his donkey. Now, if God forced him to, he'd head back home. That wasn't much of an apology, God told Balaam, but he figured it was the best he'd get. And seriously, God was so clear that he did not want Balaam to go see this king. Very clear. But Balaam kept trying to force God to let him, and God himself was tired of Balaam. He wasn't going to put any more energy into saving Balaam from himself. Like, literally don't go. It's worse than you think it's going to be. Seriously, don't do it. But God wasn't going to go out of his way to stop Balaam either, now that Balaam was so dead set on going. Thanks for the permission. Balaam touched his fingers to the top of his turban in a mock salute as he got back on his poor donkey without even saying thank you for saving his life and started plodding along toward Balak's kingdom. The permission? The audacity, God said as Balaam disappeared into the horizon. God sighed. Balaam was in for a nasty surprise when he showed up. Balak greeted Balaam with an insult. Seriously, what was wrong with this man? He had offered a very large amount of money to procure his services, and the guy had taken this long? Part of the fee was for Balaam's speed in getting to his kingdom. Balak didn't know what he'd expected, but he expected better. Balaam shrugged. He was here now, but maybe he wasn't going to be as useful as the king thought. He was limited to saying only what God wanted him to say, and that was going to be tricky because God really liked these people for some reason. But he did think that he could at least get a few good curses in. Well, he couldn't. When Balaam had built the altars and offered some animals and gone to beg God one more time to let him curse his people, Seriously, God was really patient, but this was beyond insulting. When Balaam had done that, he started chanting. In poetic verse, Balaam said things like, "Balak called me to curse these people, but they are so much better than he is, and to die by their side would be such a heavenly way to die." Balak cursed at Balaam, but Balaam continued with a, "No magic will ever work against these people, and they'll devour your kingdom and drink your blood." Balak rolled his eyes. "Has a change of scenery ever just made you really angry inside and wanting to snap at everyone?" he asked. Balaam shook his head no. What kind of dude was Balak? I mean, he was a garbage human being that whipped his pet at the slightest provocation, but even he didn't really get that aggressive with a change of scenery. Balak shrugged. "It worked for him. Let's move to another spot and maybe you can curse them from there." Balaam shook his head. No, it wouldn't work. He had been trying. He loved to curse them. He wanted to so badly. The words just wouldn't come out of his mouth. It wasn't the location. It was the power of God. Moving him would do absolutely nothing, and he would just say more bad things about Balak against his own will. "Please don't risk it," Balaam begged. But Balak forced Balaam to do the whole change in location thing, and Balak was left disappointed. After another session of "the Hebrews will break your bones in pieces," Balak shifted into loss mitigation mode. Instead of begging Balaam to curse them, he just begged him to at least stop saying good things about the Hebrews. Seriously? Balaam didn't have to curse them, but please stop praising them and wishing them goodwill. "No," Balaam shouted. He literally couldn't. He was trying so hard, but the words coming out of his mouth were the opposite of what he intended. He launched into a prophecy about the coming of Jesus Christ and how God himself would be born to the Hebrews and he would, quote, "crush the foreheads and skulls of Balak's people," end quote. Balak roared, "Get out! Get back home!" Did Balaam even know how paying someone to curse someone worked? It meant that you did not show up in the person's land and bless their enemies. He cursed at Balaam. Balaam was a disappointment. Balaam needed to leave now, before Balak changed his mind and killed the guy. So Balaam got on his old, trusty donkey and started riding back home. We could hope he had a newfound appreciation for the donkey and maybe went home realizing that he had insulted God and been a complete garbage human in general. We could hope he decided to change his ways. I wish we could, but we can't, because the story of Balaam continues and Balaam devises a nefarious plot, but that will be right after this. You'd think that after God literally forced Balaam to only say good things about a tribe of people that vastly outnumbered King Balak, Balaam would have just abandoned the desire to help Balak in any way, even if he was motivated simply by self-interest. Like, literally, magic didn't work against these people, and Balak was confident he'd lose to them in pitched battle. From a mere self-preservation standpoint, Balaam was better off choosing a different battle. Any different battle. But if you're thinking along these lines, you're not thinking like Balaam, for whom self-preservation was apparently very low on his list, and money and being a terrible person were literally numbers 1 and 2. Because Balaam showed back up in Balak's kingdom at some point. We aren't exactly sure how Balaam got Balak to trust him again, but we know that he did because Balak left his meeting with Balaam with a plan. The plan involved forcing literally all of the women in Balak's kingdom to have sex with creepy men, which is a pretty nasty plan, but I mean it's not super surprising coming from the guy who wanted to kill his pet and curse a group of people for money. The basic gist was that all the hot women in Balak's kingdom or among his allies would get together and walk into the Hebrew camps. They'd be a little bit more smooth, but they'd basically offer to have sex with Hebrew men if the men would just burn a little incense in front of a few idols first. In a group of several hundred thousand people, you are bound to have a large group who were horny enough to take this offer. And when the first guys who took this offer demonstrated to the others that these women were not the Judith kind who were going to cut off their heads after having sex, the number of guys involved in the whole thing grew exponentially. Pretty soon, a large minority of the population were worshipping the idols and having sex in wild orgies with the women in Balak's kingdom, and Balaam was smiling. If the number of people who were disobeying God reached critical mass, God could not protect the Hebrews anymore. And his spies told him that although the Hebrew camp looked big, none of them knew how to fight. Balak's trained soldiers could cut the Hebrews down. If only God wasn't protecting them. Meanwhile, a plague of disease started spreading through the camp, another result of God's protection being removed from the crew who was worshiping idols. The people, particularly the women and children who had no part in having sex with the hot foreign women or in worshiping their idols, sat in front of the temple begging God to intervene. The leaders prayed in front of the temple and paced in anxiety. It was then that a tribal leader walked by with the woman on his arm. He laughed at the superstition of the people standing in front of the temple and gave them the middle finger. In front of hundreds of people begging God for answers and for safety, the tribal leader took the women into his tent and started having sex in front of all of them. Phinehas, a priest, was insulted. This man had the audacity to walk into the camp while everyone was begging God for his protection and do exactly what had caused the trouble in the first place. In front of everyone? The priest asked the nearest warrior if he could borrow his spear, which the man handed over. He definitely wanted to see the drama unfold. Phinehas marched calmly to the tent that the tribal leader had stepped into, stabbed the spear through both the man and the woman, and walked out with the look on his face that actors have when they're walking away from explosions. With Phinehas' brutal action, the plague stopped and God resumed his protection of the Hebrews. With his action, the Hebrews rejected the idol worship and indiscriminate sex with women who were probably in fear for their very lives. The next few days were filled with instruction by God, a census for some reason, and some light reaffirmation of the rights of women. I say light because they really didn't have that many rights. As the days of instruction came to a close, the Hebrews began preparing for battle to take revenge on King Balak and Balaam for scheming against Israel. Perhaps Balak and his kingdom would have been spared if he hadn't been so dead set on harming the Hebrews, but Balak's cunning scheming and attempted brutality against the Hebrews would not go unpunished. Balaam would also be punished for his role in leading the scheme. That's about what happened. The Hebrews absolutely decimated the enemy tribes, and they killed Balaam as he ran away from the battle in cowardice and terror. They also took some sheep, donkeys, cattle, and women after defeating the enemy. Wait. Ew, you just listed women as loot you took from the battlefield in the same list as cattle. We did, the Hebrews said, and what are you going to do about it? Bomb it. This is really gross, and I am not comfortable with this. It's in the Bible. And it is. This story feels like it spins out of control, and it is really troubling to me. The story of Balaam is a pretty good, child-friendly moral tale. Don't be mean to your animals, don't try to curse good people with magic. I'm not sure anyone tries to do that, but I'll file it away just in case I'm ever tempted to start hexing Christians. The story of Balaam is one of gradual corruption, where a man who was once chosen by God to be a prophet went down a dark path. He started by allowing his anger to translate to harsh treatment of his pet, and ended up creating a vast conspiracy to hurt as many people as he could in an attempt to make some money or get some respect. We're not exactly sure what Balaam's expected reward from Balak for the new plot was. And the story surely reminds us that the way we treat animals translates to how we'll eventually treat people. The way we treat our pets, especially when we are angry, is very revealing of how we'll treat people when they screw up. And if we aren't treating our pets right, we should take a good long look at ourselves and think about changing our ways before we start treating people just as harshly. But I start having a hard time stomaching this story. I'm already questioning the fairness when they stab a man and a woman through with a spear, despite the fact that they were deliberately, openly insulting God. But when they go into battle and take women as plunder like cattle, I'm really pretty sickened. What I can say is this. These stories are about imperfect people following the custom of their time. We have to remember that God installed strict laws to protect the women who were taken as plunder. Under these strict laws, the women were well protected and better off than if they had just been left in a devastated kingdom, fully exposed to the tribes of vagabonds who went out raping and reaving. The world's view of women as a commodity is something that we as Christians need to wage vigorous battle against. And it is clear that God was already working on the Hebrews. In one of the earliest stories on the podcast, we talked about Deborah, the woman who led the Hebrews to victory over the brutal Sisera. The story of Sisera brings to light the way non-Hebrews viewed women. Sisera's people are asking why he is taking so long to return from battle, and they are conjecturing that he is taking a bee or two, if you know what I mean, as a sex slave. In contrast, Hebrew laws forbid sexual assault or dehumanization of women taken in battle. If a soldier falls in love with a woman captured in battle, they must first allow them to mourn the loss of their people, and then, if the soldier is still in earnest about marrying the woman, he must follow all the traditional rules of marriage. There is no form of sex slavery tolerated among the Hebrews. If the man wanted to cut corners or treat her as less because she was a foreigner captured in battle, he could not do so. The woman is protected by the same laws of marriage as any native-born woman. Captured women could not be enslaved. They could not be sold for money. They could not be, and I quote, treated as a commodity. In the end, the ancient worldview of women had still poisoned the Hebrews enough that they list the women along with the cattle. And that's bad. But we can give the ancient Hebrews, and God, credit for giving captured women a solid set of protections, clearly condemning the ancient world's treatment of women as nothing but free sex slaves. The Hebrews were called to a much higher standard. Though they had to fight in battles just like other tribes, they were not to act with such brutality and disregard for women's lives. Again, as Christians, we are called to repudiate the world's treatment of women. Many people treat women as objects for male gratification, and that is not okay. The Bible attempted to gradually work against a brutal and objectifying society to empower women. As Christians, we must fight to continually empower women, bring the voices of female victims to the forefront, and punish male offenders rather than blame the female victim. Sadly, that's often the opposite of what we do. We force women to wear clothing that makes them sweat to death in the summer and then still blame them when a man assaults them, accusing them of asking for it. We blame women who are assaulted by men. We don't listen to their struggles. We try to relegate them to traditionally female positions and force them to be subservient to men instead of allowing them to achieve their full potential that God has called them to. As Christians, we must put a stop to this. A last brief piece of trivia about this story. The story of Phineas stabbing the couple to death is one of the passages that Brigham Young alluded to in order to justify the bizarre theory of blood atonement. Basically, Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, and many fundamentalist Mormons believe there are certain sins that the blood of Jesus cannot forgive. To be forgiven, a person must shed their own blood. This is part of the reason that fundamentalist Mormons have demanded the firing squad be an option for capital punishment in Utah. Joseph Smith believed that blood atonement should be enforced on people who disobeyed the Mormon laws. To quote him, "Will you love that man or woman well enough to shed his blood?" He said that many people who are now lost could have been saved if some among their Mormon brothers would have, quote, "spilled their blood on the ground as a smoking incense to the Almighty," end quote. With regard to the Phineas story, Brigham Young believed that Phineas would have had all of his sins forgiven by God for stabbing the couple through, and because the couple's shed blood paid for their sins, they would go to the abodes of bliss. To quote Brigham Young himself, "I have no wife whom I love so well that I would not put a javelin through her heart, and I would do it with clean hands." Finally, Brigham Young believed that if anyone married a black person, God dictated a penalty of, and I quote, "death on the spot." He further declared that this will always be so. It should be made clear that a lot of Mormons nowadays don't know their church used to teach this, or view it as disputed doctrine that their enemies made up. But the early Mormon founders unashamedly taught this, many still believe it in secret, and it's incredibly barbaric. Not only does it assure people that they are beyond the help of God and must pay for their sins themselves, the literal opposite of the founding principle of Christianity, it encourages people that murdering others is simply doing what's best for them. And that's not what this story teaches at all. The tribal leader in this story was put to death for insulting God and his own people without any hope that either Phineas or the couple would gain holiness from it. It was merely a punishment and nothing else. That's all for this week. Next time, we'll be doing the story of another selfish, capricious prophet who has to deal with an animal. This time, it does what Balaam's donkey should have done and just swallows him. Thank you to everyone for listening. Please leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Please listen on Spotify if you can, because they allowed me to do some really cool cover art over there, and share my podcast with a friend. I also need some help getting my Spotify reviews to 5 stars. We need a certain number before Spotify displays a 5-star rating. So please go and leave your review over there, even if you don't listen on Spotify. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to listen to Tales from Sacred Texts. Credits to myself for scripting and theme music. Many thanks to open source artists and Evoke Music for creating the podcast music. I'm super grateful to everyone who helped even a little with this episode.